Okay, just to in person attendees today, I don't blame you. Not a great day out there. So today, well, first an announcement. I said earlier this week that we're likely to have our first exam immediately after, well, the week after we come back from spring break. I think that's too ambitious. More likely what's going to happen is I'm going to finish up our discussion of linear transformations today, but I'm just barely going to finish that. And then what I'd like to do is maybe Monday after we come back from spring break to go over homework problems and try to consolidate things a little bit. Rather than have a review session on Wednesday after we get back from spring break, maybe do that on Friday, and then the week after the week we come back from spring break to have the exam, probably the Monday, the second Monday after we come back from spring break to have the exam then. So I'm not going to schedule it today. What we'll do is we'll schedule the second exam on the Monday we get back from spring break. Okay, so that's kind of good because it means that you don't have to devote a whole lot of time to linear algebra over the break. You do have a homework assignment. The homework assignment, I guess, on linear transformations, I think that's homework assignment 7. That's going to be due the Monday you get back from spring break, but then you'll still have at least another week to consolidate your understanding of what we've done since the first exam. Okay, so my goal today is kind of limited. I've already introduced the topic of linear transformations and the two subspaces that one naturally attaches to a function between two vector spaces. Now, main purpose of today is to talk about if I have a linear transformation from one vector space to another, say Rm to Rn, when can I go back and forth between these two? So if I have a function that takes me from a given vector space to another one, when can I actually have an inverse map that takes me back? So that would be t the minus first. This is going to be a really important topic. When a linear transformation has a legitimate inverse function that will take you from the codomain of the original function back to the domain, that's what we call a vector space isomorphism. And those vector space isomorphisms are really fundamental in linear algebra. Not so much in the context of when our vector spaces are Rm and Rn. It's going to turn out that if you have a linear transformation that has an inverse, the only maps that are possible are from Rm to Rm itself, not to some other vector space. Because effectively, what you need in order to have an isomorphism or an invertible linear transformation is the spaces have to have the same dimension. And so effectively, you're going to have Rm to Rm. But we're going to see that today just by looking at the underlying function theory of linear transformations. All right, so let me start. Get my clicker working. There it goes. Okay, so remember linear transformation, these are special functions between vector spaces that are compatible with scalar multiplication and vector addition. Functions of this type are naturally associated with matrices. This has been a topic of lectures this week. On the one hand, if you have a matrix with n rows and n columns, you can use that matrix to define a function that goes from an m-dimensional vector space to an n-dimensional vector space. That's done using matrix multiplication. For this multiplication to be defined, since I have m rows in this first, m columns in this first factor, this second factor is going to have it exactly m rows. And so it would be interpretable as an m-dimensional vector. After I do the multiplication, though, I end up with a new vector that has n components, and that is interpretable as a vector inside Rn. So as soon as you have a n by m matrix, you can use this matrix multiplication to construct a function that will take m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors. And it will naturally satisfy these two properties. However, the main point of today's or the lectures this week is that you can go in the opposite direction as well. If you have a function between two vector spaces that satisfies these two properties, then you can define an associated matrix that will effectively implement the linear transformation via matrix multiplication. So from this, you can define a matrix. Let me give you the rule for it. What you do is you look at how T acts on the standard basis vectors for your domain. So those standard basis vectors are, of course, first one is 1, 0, 0. It's going to have m components. And the standard basis vectors, they just have a 1 in one of these slots and zeros everywhere else. So you have a bunch of them. In fact, if you start off in an m-dimensional space, you'll have exactly m standard basis vectors. So what I can do is I can apply my function to each standard basis vector. That's going to give me an n-dimensional vector as a result, and I can write that as a column. I can do that for each of the standard basis vectors. And what I end up with is a matrix with m columns and n rows. And so I get an n by m matrix. And what happens then is that linear transformation can then be implemented. Even if this was defined by some functional formula, once we create this matrix, we can replicate the action of that function via matrix multiplication. So in fact, we can go from linear transformation to matrices, and we can go from matrices to linear transformations. That's this first line, and we can go from linear transformations back to matrices. All right, now what's nice about that is that as soon as we write down this matrix, we just got a rectangular arrangement of numbers. So if we're in this setting, thinking of linear transformations as matrices, we're in this eminently calculable setting where everything in our basic objects are just numbers that we can add, multiply, etc. Okay, so as we discussed on Wednesday, were two special subspaces we can attach to a linear transformation. One is going to be a subspace of the domain, and the other is going to be a subspace of the codomain. So the starting point and the ending point of that function. The range, it's going to be a subset of the codomain. What it consists of is all the points in the codomain that you can reach by applying the linear transformation. So you may not hit every point here by applying this function. But when you restrict attention to exactly those points that are reachable by applying the linear transformation, that's the range. And what we saw this week is, in fact, that this subspace can be identified as the column space of the matrix that's associated with that linear transformation. So that makes this range easily calculable. Take the linear transformation, we compute its matrix, and then we find the basis for the column space of that matrix, and that will give us a basis for the range. There's another subspace that's attached to the domain. In this case, we focus on the points in the domain that get sent to the zero vector in the codomain once we apply the function. That's called the kernel. It's computable by referring back to the matrix that's associated to a linear transformation. It turns out it's the null space of the matrix, or in other words, it's the solution set of the linear system you get by taking the matrix corresponding to the linear transformation, multiplying a variable x by it, and demanding it that equals a zero vector. So both these guys, we compute in terms of the matrix that's attached to a linear transformation. All right, so one thing I want to point out is the dimension and the kernel here, they have a relationship between their dimensions. Let me sort of motivate this by recalling In fact, we know about matrices. The number of columns of a matrix is always equal to the rank of the matrix, that is, the dimension of the row space or dimension of the column space, plus the dimension of the null space. Let me show you why. Okay, so the rank is actually defined as the common dimension of these span of the rows of the matrix, or equivalently, the number of basis vectors you have in the span of the column of A. Both these dimensions, well, how do we count them? Well, we need to get a basis for the row space. That's done by row reducing A to a row echelon form and grabbing the non-zero rows. To get a basis for the column space, we row reduce A to row echelon form. We figure out where the pivots live, and we go back to the original matrix and use those as basis vectors. Now, basis vectors are the number of, they're the independent directions that generate the entire subspace. So when we count basis vectors, we're basically getting the dimension. In fact, it's defined as the dimension of the corresponding subspace. So how many basis vectors do I have for the row space? Well, it's good. Each basis vector corresponds to a non-zero row with a row echelon form. If you have a non-zero row, it's got a pivot in it, the first non-zero entry in that row. So the number of basis vectors is going to be equal to exactly the number of pivots you have in any row echelon form, or equivalently, the number of either way you count, it's always equal to the number of pivots in a row echelon form. Meanwhile, the dimension of the null space of a matrix, well, that's the dimension of the solution set A of x is equal to zero. And so the dimension of the solution set is going to correspond to the number of free parameters you have when you actually write down the solution of this. And that, in turn, is going to equal the number of columns without pivots. Once you try to solve this linear system, you write the augmented matrix, you row reduce to reduce row echelon form, and then in that row echelon form, you decide which variables are free and which variables are fixed variables by looking at the columns and deciding whether a column contains a pivot, that would be a fixed variable, or a column that does not have a pivot, that's going to be interpretable as corresponding to a free variable. So the free variables correspond to columns without pivots in the row echelon form. And now if you look at these numbers, I get the dimension of a row space or dimension of the column space, that corresponds to the columns of a row echelon form that have pivots. The dimension of the null space corresponds to columns without pivots. So if I add this number to this number, well, this with pivots, without pivots, I include both possibilities, so I just get the total number of columns. And so we had this identity that related the dimensions of two subspaces attached to any matrix. I'm going to do something similar for linear transformations, but now my subspaces are not going to be the rank and nullity of a matrix, but rather the range and kernel of a linear transformation. Okay, so here's my claim. If you have, anytime you have a linear transformation, you're going to have the range, which is just going to consist of all the points in the codomain that are reachable by applying the linear transformation. And you have a subspace of the domain called the kernel, which consists of all vectors in the domain that get sent to the zero vector in the codomain. My claim is that the dimension of those two subspaces is exactly equal to the dimension of the domain. And the way you see that is using the correspondence to every linear transformation, there's a matrix. So, how do we create that matrix? AT, the way we write it down is we look at the standard basis vectors for Rm, we evaluate our linear transformation on the standard basis vector, and write the result as a column. Second column would be T applied to E2, written vertically. And then your last standard basis vector is going to correspond to the last column of the matrix. You see that we have exactly m columns there if we started off with an m dimension, a linear transformation from Rm to Rn. So as soon as I have a linear transformation from Rm to Rn, I get a matrix that has exactly m columns. All right, now, we take the columns of this matrix and we can divide it up into columns that have pivots and columns that don't have pivots. But the number of columns that have pivots, those are going to correspond to the columns that are going to produce basis vectors for the column space. The recipe is that you row reduce this matrix to row echelon form. You look at where the pivots live and you go back to the original matrix and grab the corresponding column. So for each column of a row echelon form of this matrix that has a pivot, you're going to have a basis vector for this column space. And similarly, for the null space of this matrix, as we've shown seen on the last slide, it corresponds to columns of the row echelon form corresponding to pre-parameters, or columns of the row echelon form that don't contain pivots. And these two dimensions always add up to the number of columns of the original matrix. But the relationship between this matrix and this linear transformation is such that the dimension of this subspace is, in fact, this subspace is identical to the range of T. And this subspace is identical to the kernel of T. And so we get this relationship, and now we have this identity that the dimensions of the domain effectively get broken up into two parts. One is the dimension of the kernel, and then if you add to it the dimension of the range, you get exactly the dimension of the domain. The way to think about this, or at least my way of thinking about this, is I have a vector space Rm, a vector space Rn, and I have a linear transformation that's taking me between those two vector spaces. Now, this map doesn't necessarily cover the entire vector space Rn. Most likely, it just fills out some subspace of this. And that subspace is exactly what we need by the range of T. So if I, as I move across over all the points in the domain, my statement is I land on some point in the subspace called the range, this sort of flat plane that's embedded inside of Rm. So that's your range. And then what the kernel is a subspace of the domain. And it consists of all the points. Oops, let me draw this arrow better. If you start off on this subspace, which is the kernel of T, that means you land on the zero vector once you apply the transformation. So I have a subspace in the codomain and a subspace in the domain. So there's subspaces of different vector spaces, but just like the column space and row space of a matrix, we have subspaces that live in different vector spaces, but somehow their dimensions are related. And so I'm going to show you that. Well, in fact, that's what's described here. But one way to think about this is that what the kernel is tracking is it's the information that's lost from, this is an m-dimensional space. So we have the, each point you need a total of m free parameters in order to describe all the points in this domain. But it turns out that some of these guys get sent to the zero vector, which is the trivial vector. It doesn't really, it's not really a non-zero point over here. It's exactly one point. So all the information that's trapped on this kernel hyperplane inside the main, lots of different vectors there. It's all getting set to the zero vector here. So I think of that as lost information. What I lose in understanding Rm if I try to view it over here. Well, the range is this, that sort of represents the information that survives as you go from Rm to Rm via this linear transformation. And so the way to understand this formula is the total information in your domain, it's m-dimensional. Well, you lose some information. Those are the vectors that get sent to the zero vector. And then you also retain some information. Those are the vectors that get mapped over to non-zero vectors over here. All right, so that's our dimension formula. And next topic I want to talk about is it's going to be about eventual goal is to figure out when we go from one vector space to another, when can we go back? And of course, if we're losing information going over here, then we're not going to be able to go back. If think of it going from a three-dimensional space to a two-dimensional space, you've lost one dimension of information in following that function over. Well, we're going to explore that next, but before I can talk about the inverse of the function, I first need to talk about what it means to compose functions. And so let's see, I did this dimension formula. Here's the picture of what I'm talking about when I talk about composing functions. You have a function just between sets, mapping a set A to a set B, and you have another function that maps the set B to a set C, then you can compose. You can go from A to the set B, and then now you're in the domain of G. You can apply G to that point and map your way over to a point in the third set, C. But then this process of going in two jumps to this point here could be done in a single jump. That's the compose function. And usually what you do is you compute this by calculating this and then substituting result into the argument for G. And that would be the compose function. All right, so what I'm going to show you is how this functional composition, how it behaves when our functions are actually linear transformations. And so it works the same way. If I have a linear transformation from an m-dimensional vector space to an n-dimensional space, and another linear transformation that goes from the codomain of the first one to a new vector space RP, then I can compose those. But here's the statement that I want. So when I compose two linear transformations, I get a new linear transformation. And what I'm saying in this theorem is that the matrix that corresponds to the composed linear transformation is actually the matrix product of the matrices corresponding to the individual linear transformation. So if I have T from Rm to Rn, from that, I can get an associated matrix AT. T E1, T E M. And then if I also have a linear transformation that's going from Rn to Rp, I also have a matrix, As. And it's going to be S applied to, I'm going to use the same notation, the first standard basis vector for Rn. And the last one is going to be S applied to the last standard basis vector. And I write those results vertically. I can attach matrices to each of these guys. And in fact, I'll be able to, this is going to be, let's see, it's going to be an N by M matrix. This is going to be a matrix with P rows and N columns. I'll be able to multiply these two matrices together. I just have to use the matrix A subscript S as the left-hand factor because I need the number of columns of the first factor to equal the number of rows of the second factor. So this product will be well-defined, and the statement of the theorem is that, in fact, the product of these two matrices is going to be exactly the same as the matrix you would get by first figuring out what linear transformation this is, and then computing its corresponding matrix. So let me show you this with an explicit example. Here I have a function between two vector spaces that is in fact a linear transformation. It's taking two-dimensional vector, producing a three-dimensional vector. The second function is going from a three-dimensional vector space to a two-dimensional vector space, and there's the formula for it. When I compose, when I form the compose function, the rule is I first evaluate t at this point, and so I'll just substitute in for t of x1, x2. And then I apply the function s to that point, but I use the rule for s. So the rule for computing the value of s at a given vector is I add the first two components. So I'll add x1 plus x2 plus x1. And the second component is going to be the third component. And so what's going to happen here is the sum of these first and second components is going to be x2 plus x1. And the third component is going to be x1 plus x2. And so there's an explicit computation of the composition of this linear transformation T with a linear transformation S. Let's write down the corresponding matrix. That's done by evaluating this function on the standard basis vectors. Since I have a two-dimensional domain, R2, I have two standard basis vectors. The first one is going to be 1, 0. So that means taking 1 for x1 and 0 for x2. Evaluating that, I get 0 plus 1, 1, 0 plus 1, 1 plus 0 is 1. And then to get the second component, I evaluate the same function on the second standard basis vector, wherein we take x2 is equal to 1, and x1 is equal to 0. So what do I get? In the first component, I have 1 plus 0 is 1. In the second component, I have 0 plus 1 is 1. So that's the matrix corresponding to that composed linear transformation. Alternatively, I can get this matrix by looking at the individual linear transformation and calculating their matrices. So here we're going from a two-dimensional vector space to a three-dimensional vector space. So when evaluating T on the first standard basis vector is going to be 0 in the first slot, 1 in the second slot, 1 plus 0 in the third slot, so 0, 1, 1. On the second standard basis vector, that will be where x2 is equal to 1 and x1 is equal to 0, I'll get 1, 0, 1. And there it is, 1, 0, 1. And similarly, I can construct the matrix corresponding to S. And all I want to show in this is that if I take this matrix and I multiply the first matrix by it, I get the same matrix here. So here's that identity that was on in the theorem of the preceding slide. The matrix corresponding to the composed linear transformation is just the product of the matrices of the individual linear transformations. All right, so that's nice. What that means is that when you have linear transformations and you want to compose them, calculationally, you want to get to these numbers as quickly as possible, rather than dealing with variables all the time. So what we can do is we can immediately write down the matrices corresponding to these transformations, and then we can calculate the matrix not by substituting into formulas, but rather simply by multiplying matrices together. Okay, so that's how we compose linear transformations. And reason I introduced that topic was so that I can get to the principal result of today, which is discovering exactly when, if I have a linear transformation that takes me from one vector space to another, when can I go back with a well-defined function that will take me from my codomain back to my original domain. Oops, so what happened here? It looked like I lost something. Here it is. Sorry. So what I'm going to talk about in preparation for figuring out when we can invert a linear transformation is to specialize, or actually generalize, to the case when we're just looking at functions between two sets. And I'll give you a simple criterion that will tell us, given a function from a set A to a set B, when an inverse function is going to exist. So to set that up, let me remind you that the image of a function is the set of all points in the codomain that you can reach by applying the function to a point in the domain. We say that a function from one set to another is surjective if the codomain B is actually the same thing as the image. What that means is that every point here is reachable by applying the function F. There are no points in the codomain that don't come from a point of the original set A. A second property we can ascribe to a function between two sets is this notion of what's called injectivity. This is a different criterion. Here, the condition is that a function is injective, so also sometimes called to be one-to-one, if the value of a function, if two points have the same value, if the function is injective, in fact, these points had to be the same. So let me give you an example of a simple function that illustrates more clearly exactly what we're talking about here. Suppose I have a function from the real line to the real line, where f is going to send x to x squared. All right, so here's the real line. Here's the real line. Now, this function is not surjective. Why is that? Well, surjectivity means you look at the image of this thing, and it should, if it's surjective, then every point in the codomain comes from some point here. But the negative numbers here, when you're less than zero here, you're not going to reach any negative number by squaring a positive number, right? Negative one times negative one is equal to one. The image of this map is always a non-negative number. And so these guys here are never reached by applying this information, because negative numbers in the codomain, that is this target space, are never reachable via F. So it's not surjective. And that's when we say a function is injective, that's exactly the kind of thing we're trying to exclude. We want everything in the domain to be reachable from the codomain by application of the function. And this function is not injective either. Why? Because, for example, f of 1 is going to equal 1 squared equals 1, but that's the same thing as f of minus 1. So I have two different points in the domain, minus 1 and 1, that are getting mapped to the same point via this function. And that's what we try to exclude when we say a function is injective. It means that distinct points have to get mapped to distinct points. They can't land on the same point. And so that's what these notions of injective and surjective mean. The first, surjectivity means you completely cover the codomain by application of a function. And the second one means that distinct points always get mapped to distinct points. All right, now, the interest in these two properties is the following. First of all, if they're we have surjectivity and injectivity, which bijectivity means it's both surjective and injective. And to get to the point I want to get to, we say that a function is invertible if you can not only go from A to B, but you can also go backwards from the codomain back to the original set A by the application of another function. I'll label it f the minus first. What you want for this new function is that if you apply it to a point in B and then you follow it with the original function, you basically have the identity function that takes B to B. Or if you compose in the opposite order, starting with a point in A, going to B, and then using this function to go back to A, you get back to where you started with. And that's what it means to have an invertible function, that you can pass back and forth between the two. And when you do so, you just get the identity. All right, so here's the theorem that holds for anytime you have a function that's bijective. If it's bijective, then it's going to be invertible. And the reason for that is I'll show you how you actually abstractly define this invert function in the case when a function is invertible. We have a set A, we have a set B, we have a function from A to B, and it's going this way. What I want is to figure out a function f the minus first that will go in the opposite direction. All right, so here's how it's done. I'm going to assume that this function f is both surjective and injective. Because, and let's start with a point B in the domain of this function that's going to end up being the inverse of A. We start here. Well, because it's surjective, this point had to come from some point here. So if B is a point in B, then it has to equal F of A for some point of A. But because it's injective, we only have one choice here. If we had two different points in A that landed on the same point here, then it would not be injective. So we're actually eliminating by stating that the function is not only surjective but injective, we're eliminating the possibility that this particular point B here could have come from two different points. So it has to come from one point because it's surjective, and it can only come from one point because it's also injective. And so that guy doesn't, that auxiliary point doesn't occur. And so, in fact, although I don't have a formula for the inverse of B, I know that it exists simply because the function is surjective and injective. Okay, so the way I want you to understand this is that just to know that a function has an inverse, it suffices to check that you can reach every point of B by applying the function to some point of the first set A. And you need to verify that two points of the original set never land on the same point in the codomain. If those two conditions hold, then the function, it's going to have an inverse. Okay, now let's apply this function theory to the case at hand, where we're looking at functions between between vector spaces, linear transformations. Well, so first statement is that a linear transformation is going to be surjective only if the range of the linear transformation is the entire codomain. That's not really much of a lemma. It's just chasing definitions. Thinking of this as a function, it's going to be surjective if every point here gets mapped to the image set Rn. Well, the image set Rn is exactly the range. And so this is just terminology. If the entire codomain is the image of the linear transformation, then the linear transformation is surjective. All right, what about injectivity? Next lemma tells us that if we have a linear transformation between two vector spaces, then it's going to be injective only if the kernel is equal to zero. I can show this real quickly. First thing I'm going to point out is that anytime you have a linear transformation, the zero vector always gets mapped to the zero vector. So no matter what this function is, no matter what this linear transformation is, I know its value at the point x equals zero inside the domain. And the reason for that is t applied to zero, I can rewrite that as t applied to x minus x, for any vector x. The difference between x and itself is always going to produce the zero vector. But because it's a linear transformation, t of x minus x is actually t of x plus t of x minus x. You can think of it this way, t of plus minus 1 times x. And then let me write it that way, minus 1 times x. I can do this because linear transformations are compatible with vector addition. And so I can take that vector sum and I can delay it until after I apply the function. But it's also compatible with scalar multiplication. And so you have t of x minus t of x. And that shows you that t of zero upon evaluation always equals the zero vector, because in the end, it's going to be t of x minus t of x. All right, so this shows you that one thing that always lives inside the range of a linear transformation is the zero vector. All right, so now let me show you that, give you a criteria for injectivity. Suppose the kernel of a linear transformation, suppose T is injective. I want to calculate the kernel. And so let's suppose the kernel consists of all the vectors that get sent to zero. So I've already shown you that zero, its value is always going to be equal to the zero vector in the codomain. Suppose I have another vector that lands on the same spot. In injectivity, what we're trying to make sure is that two vectors don't land on the same spot. So I know zero lands on zero. What if x lands on zero, but x is not equal to zero? Well, that would contradict t being injective. If here I have two points in the domain landing on having the same value. And if they're not the same point, then I've contradicted the fact that it's injective. So so in other words, the kernel of T, it only consists of a single point, the zero vector. And so if T is injective, then necessarily the kernel of T, the set of points that land on zero, it can only be the zero vector. In the opposite direction, now I'm going to show you if the kernel is equal to zero, then necessarily T is injective. So look at the condition for injectivity. If you land on the same spot, so t evaluated x1 is equal to t of x2. If that happens, then necessarily just move this term to the opposite side by subtracting it from both sides. Then you get 0 is equal to t1 minus t2. Because you have a linear transformation, you can delay that scalar multiplication and vector addition until you can equally well do it before you apply the linear transformation. I'm sorry, that's not a plus sign, just the mouse is on top of it. I can do that vector subtraction before I apply it, but then now I have 0 is equal to t applied to x1 minus x2. So the value of t applied to this particular vector equals 0. But my hypothesis is that the only way I can reach 0 on the in the codomain is by applying t to the 0 vector. And so if value of t applied to this vector is equal to 0, and the kernel of t consists of only the 0 vector, then x1 minus x2 have to equal 0. And so we get this condition, which tells you that x1 has to equal 2, x2. So if the kernel is equal to 0, then and t of x1 is equal to t of x2, that's going to imply that x1 has to equal x2. And so, and that means if whenever you have the same value, you have to come from the same point, that means that t is injective. Okay, oops, I'm just about out of time, but I can just give you the punchline here. A linear transformation between two vector spaces is going to have an inverse. Well, from function theory, we know that just general function theory, if a function between two sets is injective and surjective, then you have an inverse. What we've just developed is criteria for a linear transformation to be surjective and injective. If the range of t is equal to Rn, that's going to imply it's surjective. If the kernel of t is equal to the 0 vector, that's going to imply it's injective. But if a function is both surjective and injective, then it has an inverse. And so there's our theorem. A linear transformation between two vector spaces is going to have an inverse so long as the function t completely covers the codomain Rn, that's surjectivity, and simultaneously, the only vector that gets sent to the 0 vector is the 0 vector itself of the domain. If those two conditions hold, then the linear transformation is going to be invertible. So I guess I'll finish today by just introducing a definition. We say that a linear transformation is an isomorphism exactly when these two conditions hold, exactly when there's an inverse linear transformation. Okay, so I've got the theory presented today, but actually there's a lot more discussion that should take place so that you actually get some more intuition as to what we're requiring here. It's going to turn out that vector space isomorphisms are really the key structure that makes linear algebra so useful. It's not so useful in the context that we've been working with thus far, where we're looking at vector spaces that are just ordered lists of numbers. What you're generally seeking when you're dealing with a vector space in an application, it might be a solution set of a set of linear differential equations. It might be solution set of some linear system. What we like to do is have vector space isomorphisms that can take an abstract vector space and map it into a concrete calculable vector space. That's where vector space isomorphisms are really crucial. And so what I'll do once you get back from spring break is I'll talk a little bit more about how vector space isomorphisms are used to now bring take our arena of what constitutes a vector space and makes it much broader, and so that it can actually handle all possible applications of linear algebra as well. Okay, so I'll stop here. And we'll pick up with this discussion on Monday when you come back from spring break. Yeah, you too. Yeah.